All right, Mr. Johnson, you're up.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. As several circuits applying RLUIPA have held, when a plaintiff presents evidence that a prison earlier permitted the religious practices at issue without incident, that evidence generally precludes summary judgment for the prison under RLUIPA's strict scrutiny prongs. Similarly, several circuits applying RLUIPA have held that summary judgment may not be granted to the defendants where there is evidence that other prisons permit the religious practices at issue without incident. This court's recent decisions in Musazada and Garner confirm that the Fifth Circuit is in keeping with both lines of these courts' case of these circuits' cases. And this case involves both situations. The Michael unit, where Chance is housed, is specifically designed to accommodate Native American practitioners. And in keeping with that designation, the defendants earlier allowed communal pipe smoking for 12 years, twice a month pipe ceremonies for 7 years, a separate pipe for Chance on several occasions, indoor smudging for 11 years, weekly teaching ceremonies for several years before 2009, observing all four Native American holy days, the wiping away the tears ceremony for 3 years, and allowed another inmate to keep a lock of a relative's hair for 7 years. As this court indicated in Musazada, RLUIPA is a statute that embodies the most demanding test known to constitutional law as a matter of statutory law. And if a prisoner can't survive summary judgment under these circumstances, when there's both substantial evidence of the past practice of the prison and substantial evidence of the practices of other prisons, it's hard to imagine when a prisoner could ever establish a RLUIPA claim. The common sense of our position is, as Judge Holmes, Justice Holmes, famously put it, a page of history is worth a volume of logic. Now take the case of communal pipe smoking specifically. There's evidence in the record
about putting all these cases in one blob. I mean, it seems to me that particular institutions and their particular problems are different, and I don't know why a judge shouldn't be able to consider that on summary judgment and not be locked in because in some other prison they found to the contrary.
There are two answers to that, Your Honor. First of all, you don't even have to look at the evidence of other prisons. You can look at the evidence of this prison. So you're raising a point really about to what extent should deference be given to the judgments of other prisons in other states and other potentially other circumstances. You don't have to reach that question in this case.
Yeah, but I mean, doesn't that just assume that conditions never change and the considerations that the institution has to make changes?
And certainly there could be changes in circumstances, and certainly there could be changes in circumstances between different states' prisons. But the burden under RLUIPA is on the government to establish that it satisfies strict scrutiny, the least restrictive means of satisfying a compelling governmental interest. Right. It's the government's burden, of course. So when credible evidence is presented that other states and the federal government do the same thing, it's incumbent upon the government to say, well, actually, those states are different for some reason. And that's the common sense of this court's statement in Garner, that we look at California, we look at the federal prisons, they allow the same thing, we find that evidence to be persuasive of what is feasible. Here the evidence actually is quite a bit more extensive. On the core issue of communal pipe smoking, there's evidence in the record and cases of which the court can take judicial notice that shows that 12 different states allow communal pipe smoking. The federal government allows communal pipe smoking. In fact, the federal government allows prisoners to keep individual pipes in their own cells. So there's strong evidence that every practice at issue here has been allowed by this prison system and by several others. And the issue here is simply whether that's enough evidence to withstand summary judgment.
What about the evidence that the record, summary judgment record, will show as to this prison, changes in circumstances such as funding, staff, things like that?
Well, I think it's important to take each of their considerations for each of the practices at issue.
All right, start with the lock of hair.
Lock of hair, okay. There they raise principally safety-related concerns related to contraband. But there's evidence.
Is there anything in the record that says what a lock of hair is. Is it an entire wig, or is it truly just a little curl?
It's a lock. I mean, I don't know that lock is defined, but it's not a wig. And a chance presented evidence that for 7 years, an inmate by the name of, I think it was John Rose, was allowed to have such a lock.
Is there any evidence on whether a lock is large enough to conceal a knife or a pistol or anything like that?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that it's not. That could certainly be sorted out.
What does the prison say is the effect on safety and by letting them have a lock?
The prison has not raised concerns about things like knives. They have raised concerns about there could be chemicals in the hair, to which we have responded, well, you could inspect the lock of hair, as you do with mail, as you do with other religious items that are submitted to the prisoners. Prisoners are allowed to have Native American religious devotional materials, for example, a feather or something like that. And the government's response is, well, that comes from an approved vendor. Well, obviously, in the case of a lock of hair of a relative, there's going to be no approved vendor. So the question is, under strict scrutiny, is it a reasonable alternative to say, in the case of this hair, you inspect the hair itself? And the very fact that they allowed this practice for a prior inmate, and there's no contrary evidence, I would note, on this. The only thing that they say is that they don't keep property records going back this far. But if they've allowed it, it stands to reason that it could be allowed again. So that's the issue with the lock of hair.
Is there any evidence that a lock of hair has ever been found to contain chemicals?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor, that not specifically. It's all been about the potential for that to happen. And there's evidence from Chance's expert that the Nebraska prisons allow this approach. So you have evidence both that this prison system has allowed this approach and that the Nebraska system has allowed this approach. And the question is, does this sort of evidence create a genuine factual dispute for purposes of summary judgment? We think it's clear that it does.
There's no nothing in the record indicating the amount of hair that the prisoner wanted to keep. I mean, whether it's an inch or a half inch or 2 inches or...
Your Honor, I confess, standing here, I don't remember anything in the record that defines what a lock of hair is. I will confirm that with my co-counsel, and on rebuttal, we'll tell you if there's anything that defines it. To my knowledge, Chance's religious beliefs can be practiced with a modest lock of hair. He doesn't need a wig. He doesn't need something. And I would think that in any event, a visual inspection or some sort of chemical test could determine whether there's anything in the hair that's problematical. If I may turn back to the issue of the pipe smoking, communal pipe smoking is something that was allowed here for 12 years. And in various occasions, Chance was allowed to individually have his own pipe. Now, the defendants say that actually after this lawsuit began, they began taking the position that communal pipe smoking was a health hazard. And they offered a testimony from their medical expert. And I think it's instructive to look at that testimony. The defendants say this is unrebutted medical testimony, but that's not in fact the case. It's rebutted by 12 years of actual experience. The defendant's expert admitted that there was not a single incident of any health risk that materialized related to this. No evidence of that. There are, of course, the other states that allow this.
Well, in this instance, Mr. Chance has tuberculosis and he has hepatitis. So, I mean, he has an illness of his own, which I haven't read all of the cases cited in there, but I did look at some of them. And I'm not saying that's the end of the discussion, but
I understand.
In just trying to get a handle on the landscape here, looking at a lot of these other cases, I didn't see a circumstance where the plaintiff or petitioner or somebody had an illness. I mean, he's got hepatitis, got to it. That part's undisputed. So to what extent is that a piece of the calculus that's instructive? In other words, if what's said here, look, spot that for 12 years or whatever period of time they allowed it, all right? So they get an opinion from somebody who comes in and inspects and says, well, we note that you've been doing X. Did you know that you're creating a risk or a hazard? Well, no, we didn't know that. Well, now you know. Under the policy or whatever, you can't do it. So they stopped doing it. So how does it advance the argument to say that for some prior time you did it, but upon advice from a health inspector, the auditor, whatever, it says you need to stop doing this because of X? So, I mean, does the prior practice really get you where you want to be?
It's a fair question, Your Honor, but the record...
Well, I try to ask fair questions as opposed to unfair ones.
I've had some of both, but the record clearly answers your question, Your Honor.
Okay.
The expert here did not say there was any risk of transmission of hepatitis C and tuberculosis. And the defendant's own submissions earlier in the case, when the only claim was for an individual pipe, from the Center for Disease Control, were specifically that these diseases are not transmitted. They said you can use the communal pipe. Look carefully.
But within, not to cut you off, these cases start running together. I'm trying to read our brief, but didn't I read that there's either some complaint or there was a complaint or something, even from another prisoner or somebody who had a concern about the fact that Mr. Chance has a, correct me if I'm wrong, because I've read these briefs a long time, but didn't that surface somewhere below?
Two prisoners raised concerns. One of them was Chance, based on a religious compulsion that I may be putting people at risk, was his thought, my religious beliefs prohibit me from doing that. Now, he's obviously not a medical expert, and the undisputed medical evidence from the CDC, and including Dr. Williams, their own expert, there's no evidence that these diseases are transmitted. But he came to court asking for an individual pipe, as they provide in the federal prisons, and the TDCJ changed its policy and said, we're ending all use of communal pipes because of the risk of things like the flu and, you know, things like that. They did not cite hepatitis C. I urge you to look carefully at Dr. Williams' affidavit in that regard, and he specifically says that you can mitigate the risk by sanitizing the pipes between uses. So from the defendant's own mouth, you have evidence of a less restrictive means. But the other prisoner who raised the concern, he knew that Chance had these diseases, and he was somewhat uneasy with it too. And so, you know, we can't deny that there have been, you know, some concern expressed about this.
Does the record reflect under what circumstances prisoners at this prison can smoke cigarettes?
There's a no tobacco policy in general, Your Honor.
All right, so there's no smoking of cigarettes.
That's my understanding.
Okay.
I'm sure Mr. Geiser will correct me if I'm wrong. But so you have a situation where you're not dealing with unrebutted testimony. You're dealing with testimony that's frankly very narrow and carefully worded. In fact, the way it's worded, it says he was asked whether establishing a policy of allowing communal pipe use was okay. It appears they didn't even tell their expert that they had a policy for 12 years of allowing communal pipe smoking. But at a minimum, when you have 12 states and the federal government and probably others, this is what we were able to unearth so far, using this sort of practice, that suggests that there's not a big health risk. Clearly, the federal government looks very carefully at these issues in determining whether their communicable diseases are going to be transmitted. Now, on the issue of the frequency of the ceremonies, I would specifically note or direct the court to the testimony of Chaplain Lowry, which you'll find at pages 1003 and 1004 of the appendix. She was specifically asked whether she could oversee these ceremonies, and she said that she could if she were trained. She said it didn't compromise her religious beliefs. If she were trained, she could do it. She says, if I was trained, but it is not in the policy. But if this was to be the policy today, would you be able to get trained in order to supervise Native American pipe ceremonies? Yes. And is it in any way against your personal beliefs to hold pipe ceremonies at the Michael Unit? As a chaplain, it is my job. So the main objection they've raised here with respect to the frequency of the ceremonies is that they don't have sufficient oversight. But their own chaplain testifies that she could oversee these things with appropriate training. And there's also...
Well, she does have a few other things to do if she's going to supervise all these other activities. You know, there's a limit to how much a chaplain can oversee.
But bear in mind, Your Honor, this is a unit that's designated for Native American prisoners. And look carefully at the testimony. The defendants say, if this were accommodated, we'd have to find the time and space. They never even actually aver that the time and space isn't available. They just sort of create the specter of, we'd have to accommodate it. Well, that's a truism. But in fact, chance presented evidence that, that these ceremonies have been overseen by non-Native Americans in the past, and Lowry confirmed that that's possible.
In this unit, how many are there? How many Native American prisoners? Do you have an idea?
I believe it's around 300, Your Honor. I'll confirm that.
And they're different from different tribes, and they all, and many of them have different traditions. Isn't that right?
There are some variations in tradition, yes, as there are in other faiths. With that, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. All right, Mr. Geiser.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Summary judgment was proper because TDCJ instituted each policy at issue here based on its officials' experience and expertise, supported by concrete facts, data, and examples.
All right, for a finite period of time, you allowed it. You know, reach another point, the prison changed course. So, you know, counsel officer says, well, that counts for a lot. The fact that what you now say is prohibitive was allowed at an earlier period of time. So what's TDCJ resting on principally as the basis for changing the policy?
Well, it varies depending on which policy we're talking about.
All right, well, let's start with the pipe smoking.
The pipe practice is that we were simply not aware of the risk that the communal pipe practice posed. And Dr. Williams, in his deposition testimony, actually notes this, that he wasn't aware of the practice. This is at page 1128 of the record. He wasn't aware of the practice until he was asked about it in response to the grievances from Chance and the other inmate. And then Dr. Williams also explained in detail why it's essentially impossible for us to pinpoint any outbreaks or any other transmissions of disease that occurred in the past. And so what we have here with the pipe practice is medical testimony that has not been refuted by any other expert testimony establishing this risk. And once we establish that risk, we're entitled under Cutter and the deference articulated under Cutter.
Okay, back up a step.
Certainly.
Articulate for us what you are saying, the risk that was defined by the expert.
The risk as defined by Dr. Williams is that allowing this communal pipe practice to go on, even with an accommodation like sanitizing the pipe between uses, would threaten the health of the inmates because of how easily communicable diseases spread in a closed population like a prison. And Chance.
All right, counsel opposite says the federal government and 12 other prisons have the same situation, same circumstance, presumably the same information. Hopefully that doesn't mean some care more about health and safety than others, but it at least makes the argument, okay, here it is, similar population. So what does the expert say, or I'm assuming somebody asked the expert to account for the differential or sanitary methods or whatever? Is it cost prohibitive? What?
Well, as an initial matter, the only prison of comparable size that Chance has mentioned is the federal prison, and I don't believe they allow the communal pipe practice, and that's on their policy is on, I believe, 1375 of the record. I think that takes care of that. But I think the more important issue here, Your Honor, is that even though those other prisons certainly have an interest in security, not every prison warden will have the same tolerance for that risk. Just because one prison has deemed a practice acceptable from a risk standpoint, that cannot mean that ties the hands of every other prison warden in the country.
Well, but the question was more to, presumably here you've got experts, you know, who are testifying. I would assume somebody asked the expert, okay, if you're opining that there's a risk here, health, da 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 da. There are seven other prisoners, similarly situated petitioners who do X. How does your opinion account for the differential in terms of health needs? What do they do that you say can't be doing here? I'm trying to figure out what's in the summary judgment record vis-a-vis this question, whether there's tension there and there's a genuine issue of fact. And I'm always leery when people say, well, something's undisputed. Sound to me like they may have disputed. So what does he say? Does he account for the other prisons at all? Or is it your argument, what you say, every prison is different?
I'm not aware of our expert ever being asked about other prisons.
Okay.
But he does make clear what the basis for his testimony is, and that's his expert medical conclusion. And if Chance had wanted to refute that factual basis for our determination to ban the communal pipe ceremony, he was certainly able to introduce medical expert testimony of his own. And had he done that and had that person said, Dr. Williams doesn't know what he's talking about, then certainly there's a fact issue and you should remand. But that's not in the record. And now as to Chance's, sorry.
How many of the American Indians want to participate in the communal pipe rally?
About upwards of 150 were participating in the communal pipe practice. And so now the command, so this goes to, I think it was one of Chief Judge Stewart's questions about focusing on the tuberculosis and the hepatitis. And so it's not really about those two diseases, because the concern is that all those inmates have various diseases that we either can't detect because they aren't symptomatic yet, or just various other diseases. And so that's why those two diseases aren't really as much of a concern. But Chance also mentioned that he has a security expert who refuted this testimony about the communal pipe practice. But that is simply not what the security expert said. Security expert was James Aiken, and he mentions four state prisons. And nowhere does he even specify whether those other prisons use the pipe practice, the communal practice, or some other practice. And so nowhere in Aiken's report or anywhere else in the record is there any indication that those other prisons have solved the problems that TDCJ has identified. And that's important because, as the cases show, the purpose of looking to these other policies isn't to force them on the defendant prison. It's to see if there's another accommodation out there that might satisfy our compelling interests. That's why the cases that have looked to those other prisons, like the Ninth Circuit in War Soldier or this court in Garner, have done so only where the defendant prison has failed to explain why a practice might alleviate its concerns.
Well, the district court, I think as to the pipe smoking, at least found that the prison's policy did burden the rights of the defendant, but that the current practice was the least restrictive means. So looking to the other prisons at least informs the question of what are other restrictive means or least restrictive means, not necessarily that because they do it, you do it, but in the question of having found there is the burdens, the policy does burden this particular petition. So moving to the next step of, well, is this the least restrictive means, that seemed at least arguably to be the rub, and in part, counsel officer saying, where there's sort of a genuine issue of material fact, if you will, or at a minimum, you're not entitled to summary judgment as a matter of law on that question at the summary judgment stage, if that's an arguable point about the least restrictive means. Whether you would prevail at the end of the day is a different question, but at least at the Rule 56 stage, to say there's an arguable point here about what the least restrictive means is, given a finding by the district court that the petitioner's rights are burdened. So what do you say?
We don't disagree that some of those other prisons might use means that are less restrictive with regards to Chance's religious beliefs. But that doesn't mean that those means do not thwart our compelling interests. And so that's the problem. We have explained in detail why each of the accommodations that he's raised, and even some of them that hasn't, thwart our compelling interests, including sanitizing between uses, where Dr. Williams didn't just say that it would mitigate, he said that it would not mitigate to an acceptable level of risk that he could then condone.
This. I mean, why couldn't you have some Clorox solution and one guy smokes a pipe and they dip it in the Clorox and pass it on to the next guy? I mean, how difficult would that be to do?
Dr. Williams actually addresses that. I believe it's on around page 901 of the record, and his explanation is that even if you wash your hands, you Clorox the pipe, but then in normal conversation, you touch your face, you touch your mouth, you touch something else, then you touch the pipe again, it contaminates that pipe to the point where you haven't achieved anything by sanitizing the pipe. And what I'd like to note is that that's his medical conclusion.
Well, let's back off from the trees and look at the forest. Texas has gone to the great extent of having one prison just for Native Americans. Why do they do that if it's not because they have different practices than the general prison population? And what's the big deal about letting them do their religious things? I mean, it's easy for the prison people to just repeat the Simon Says, it's the least restrictive thing. But if you back off and look at it, it looks like they've established this, and now they're doing everything they can to minimize it.
Well, as an initial matter, it's not just this unit. There are actually several units that are Native American designated. But to get to really the heart of your question, Your Honor, just the fact that it's designated as a Native American faith unit doesn't mean that we can ignore our obligations about health and security with regards to those, the Native American faith adherents, or the rest of the inmates in the prison. And so once we have that medical testimony, that establishes as a factual matter that there is a risk.
And the records show how many non-Native American prisoners there are?
I do not remember how many total inmates are in the Michael unit. I want to say it's about 16 to 1700, but I would have to double check that to be sure.
For roughly half?
No, there are only about 330 inmates in the Michael unit. And so the point is that the mere fact that another prison uses a policy can't be determinative of this issue, and it also can't even defeat summary judgment, because we're entitled to make that determination about the risk once we've established that that risk exists. And he has nothing to undercut that risk, again, because we've explained why we can't identify the outbreaks under the previous policy.
Tell me succinctly, what does the summary judgment consist of?
Sorry, I'm not sure I understand the
question. What does the summary judgment record consist of? Obviously, your expert's testimony or deposition is part of it. Is that right?
No, that's part of it. There, we have reports from several TDCJ officials on security issues, the director of chaplaincy operations. So his testimony is important too, especially the frequency of ceremonies. There's deposition testimony, there's reports, things of that nature. There's quite a bit.
So the only expert testimony is the TDCJ expert?
We had the only expert testimony on medical issues. Chance introduced an expert report from James Aiken, who was labeled as a security expert, but his report really is entirely conclusory, and Chance's opening brief actually never even mentions Aiken. And I think that's because, as this court knows, mere conclusory assertions by an expert witness will not defeat summary judgment. Then the second expert on Chance's side was a religious expert, and that's actually the person who testified to hair being kept in the Nebraska prison. And so just to turn quickly to the hair, since it seems like it caught the court's interest, a couple things there. First of all, that was presented by the religious expert, so she couldn't comment on any security concerns, and that evidence also wasn't brought to the district court's attention. And she admitted that she had never even looked in a medicine bundle. But the more important points on the hair are that we do assert a concern, and this is at page 72 of our brief, that a lock of hair might hide, even a small lock of hair, might hide dangerous contraband like a needle. And that's what the Sixth Circuit found in Hovenar versus Lazaroff. And that problem is compounded here because the hair is a sacred item that we can't search to examine for contraband. We also raised the issue that receiving an item from an individual outside the prison is a huge...
Couldn't the prison condition the receipt of a lock of hair on consent to search it?
That's not in the record because it was never raised. And so I'm not sure. I can tell you that Chance has filed a grievance against us for what he claims, having touched a religious item before. And so I'm given that grievance, I think that probably explains why we didn't raise that with him, and he has never mentioned it as a possibility.
And couldn't you limit the size of the lock of hair to a half inch in length or something that it'd be almost impossible to smuggle drugs in with it?
I'm not sure if that's possible because that depends on Chance's religious beliefs. He hasn't said how big that lock of hair has to be.
Counsel opposite says that he doesn't see any problem with limiting the size. I mean, that's my understanding of what he said.
Then, I mean, again, the problem with some of these options being raised this late is that we don't have the record for it. And as courts have held, we need not refute every conceivable option. And so if something like this, and this gets into one of his complaints on the smudging question, if something like this is something that was amenable to Chance under his religious beliefs, then it's late for him to raise that in an attempt to defeat summary judgment.
I didn't see anything in the record about Chance wanting any particular size lock of hair. I mean, I don't see that he's certainly not asking for a wig or anything huge. Now, it just seems to me like it's not an issue that was talked about, the size.
I agree. I'm not aware of any discussion in the record. And there's also the retaliation concern.
I mean, but can you see any reasonable chance of hiding something in a half-inch lock of hair?
I'm not an expert in prison security, but that was the concern that we raised about hiding things in the lock of hair. And so given, again, the deference owed under Cutter, I mean, I think we're entitled to make the determination on that risk. I would like to address something with the frequency of ceremonies.
Tell me about that. I mean, the inmate is not entitled to question justification for disallowing a practice. They've got to defer to it.
I'm sorry. Can you, the beginning.
I mean, you said that an institution's entitled to deference, but the inmate is certainly entitled to question that, and then you have to justify it, is my understanding.
Certainly, I think that's correct.
Where does the deference come in? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Well, deference comes in examining whether a policy advances or thwarts our compelling interest. And so if we believe, based on our history with contraband, that's a problem, then we're entitled to make that determination if he hasn't presented any evidence to the contrary. So I think.
I mean, don't you have to present some evidence that it does present a problem of health, safety, security, or something of that nature?
Certainly, and we have, based on our experiences with the contraband. And so this goes back also to, with the pipe practice, with our experience with inmates confiscating or secreting tobacco onto their persons, and tobacco disappearing from other ceremonies and things like that. So it's those facts that give weight to our opinions. And
you have the burden of proof here, isn't that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And we believe that we've carried that based on those facts that we've cited. One quick point on the frequency of ceremonies mentions Chaplain Lowry being willing under her beliefs to supervise the ceremonies, but the problem is, as Dr. Grobsmith, who is Chance's religious expert, testified, we need a pipe carrier for those ceremonies. And a pipe carrier is someone who is considered sincere in their beliefs, worthy of holding the pipe. And so that's the problem. And that's also the problem with his other claims about the frequency of ceremonies, in that we can't force a pipe carrier to appear at the unit. We also can't force a non-Native American volunteer to appear at the unit. And so I think that takes care of that claim. It also takes care of the Holy Days claim, because that largely resolves around just a request for additional pipe ceremonies. To touch on smudging, this is another situation where facts have changed to overcome the prior practice. We fully admit that we used to conduct the smudging ritual in the gymnasium, but we have never conducted the smudging ritual in a room with a fire alarm. And that's what the gymnasium has now.
Well, going back to an earlier question somewhat, you have this designated unit, and given what's in this case, what remains of any Native American religious practices that have not been prohibited?
Your Honor, with respect, I think that we actually do quite a bit for the Native American faith adherents at the unit. We have four ceremonies, including the pipe ceremony. I know that the pipe ceremony isn't how chance wants it, but given our concerns about health and security, it's the best we can do. So we have that, plus three other weekly ceremonies. They're allowed to keep various religious items that are listed in the policy cited in the record. And there are a few other things that Mr. Pierce discusses in his affidavit. Sorry, were you asking? And so back to the smudging, again, we can't be asked to incur the risk of triggering a fire alarm and having to evacuate a maximum security prison.
You don't have an area that's sheltered that does not have a fire alarm?
I see my time's expired. May I answer the question?
There's never a red light on a judge's question.
You know? Thank you. Thank you, Chief Justice. We do not have an area outside for that.
I mean, it's just a sheltered area or a room that doesn't have a fire alarm in it?
Not outside, and I guess the answer, to put it briefly, is no, we do not have that.
Okay. All right, Mr. Geiser, we're going to turn you loose from the podium.
Thank you very much.
All right, appreciate it. All right, back to you, Mr. Johnson, for rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Judge Stewart.
Now, back up to a question I asked. So you didn't put an expert on to rebut their expert on these health, safety, et cetera, issues. Is that accurate?
We put on an expert with 39 years of experience in prison administration who testified that it would be safe and that other prisons' practices demonstrate that it would be safe to use these sorts of pipe smoking practices.
All right, let me ask it a different way. Their expert was Dr. Williams. Is that right?
Correct.
All right, who opined about the health safety reasons, yada, 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 right?
Correct.
All right, I know you had a chaplain, somebody on that practice. Do you have an expert that's locked in on Dr. Williams' testimony that takes a different point of view that creates what we generically find genuine issues of material fact because it's an expert battle?
We have the defendant's own submission from the Center for Disease Control, which you'll find at page 1354 of the appendix. And it says that tuberculosis and hepatitis C cannot be transmitted.
It amazes me how counsel answer questions they wish were asked, but they don't ask. Answer the question that we're asked.
We do not have a medical expert.
See how easy that was?
But the CDC, their own evidence.
I'll let you explain the answer, but you got to answer my question first.
I
just want to be clear. There was no expert.
Well, we do have a warden who testified about safety.
Was he he was qualified as an expert?
I believe so, Your Honor.
All I'm asking is informational, you know. It's just to be clear in my head what's in the record. Question is, there was no expert put in to traverse Dr. Williams on the points that he opined, correct?
On the medical issue.
All right,
correct.
Your follow-up is that you have other evidence in the record that you say traverse that. You just don't have an expert. Is that accurate?
Correct.
All right, thank you.
And their own expert says the risk, this is a quote, the risk of disease transmission could be mitigated by such measures as sterilization between users. You'll find that on page 577. So you really, deference only gets you so far. RLUIPA embodies the most demanding test known to constitutional law, as this court recognized in Musazada. Here, you have 12 years of actual practice, 12 states, the federal government, all saying that pipe smoking, frequently communal pipe smoking, does not threaten health. Whether we have a medical expert or not is frankly irrelevant in light of their own evidence, which creates a factual dispute on this.
Well, it's not necessarily irrelevant if you're trying to get past Rule 56 into a trial. It may be irrelevant on the merits, but you're at the posture of trying to get past Rule 56, correct?
And you can get past Rule 56 if the defendant's own evidence gives you what you need. That's my point. So
somebody, the defendant's, well, let's see, you, somebody cited to a case to it. Never mind. Go ahead.
Let me answer a couple questions that were asked earlier about things in the record. The size of the hair, for example. Defendants allow medicine bags. Those medicine bags, and you'll find this at page 94, can be 2 1/4 inches by 3 inches. That's how big the bag is. So the hair lock has to fit within that, and frequently there are other items in it as well. So that tells you the hair lock has to be smaller than that. John Rose used his medicine bag, Chance submitted evidence that to carry the lock of hair, so it was of that size. You asked about the number of Native American inmates in the Michael unit. There are 342, that's on page 438. I'd like to say something about this issue of deference again on the pipe smoking. The defendants are really trying to have it both ways. The Yellowtail settlement, which you'll find on page 82 of the record, obligates them to allow pipe smoking. Now they're saying, well, on the one hand, if you do it individually, you have these problems. On the other hand, if you do it communally, you have these problems. There has to be some means of accommodating the religious practice of praying in the Native American tradition. This is akin to telling a Protestant Christian that only the priest can pray on your behalf, or a Catholic that you can't partake of Mass. This is a core religious practice.
Talking about the communal pipe smoking now?
Correct.
Okay.
And so it seems to me that if you conclude that there are health issues with the communal approach, and we think that there's a disputed issue of material fact on that, then the solution is to accommodate via the individual pipe smoking. But it can't be that there's no opportunity for Native American pipe use in the Texas prisons. We urge the court to reverse.
All right. Thank you, counsel, both sides.